This weekend sees the kickoffs of both the European Football Championship across Europe and the Copa America in Brazil. Next month, at least in theory, the Olympic Games will begin in Tokyo. The organisers of all of these events will be resolute in their determination that they be seen to be rigidly apolitical, that sport must operate on a plane entirely untethered to the real world. It is also likely that some politicians and some fans will take theatrical offence at any sullying of sport by politics. This is, of course, nonsense. Sport, especially international sport, is inherently political. Sport is a means of expressing national pride, furthering national interests, and waging national rivalries. Not for nothing did George Orwell once describe sport as war minus the shooting. The European Football Championship, the Copa America, and the Olympic Games will all heave with political subtext, machination, and intrigue. They will be, as always, at least as absorbing for observers of diplomacy as for fans of football or discus hurling. Why do we insist on pretending that sport isn't political? And is it necessarily a bad thing if it is? This is the Foreign Desk.
I think Carlos and Smith in Mexico drew international attention to what was going on in the States and was part of the whole narrative of the 1960s. Politics in sport does affect and can be successful, whether you like it or not.
Internationally, at this point, I think what soft power there might have been is really waning. What he will be banking on, Suga, is a successful Olympics, hopefully one where Japan wins lots of gold medals, and that will boost his status domestically.
In 95, that cup final, I think probably the biggest surprise was Mandela going the whole hog and coming out in the Springbok jersey. He was a star, wasn't he, Mandela? And he absolutely didn't put a foot wrong. And one of the reasons for embracing the Rugby World Cup instead of shunning it was that he realized he desperately needed the white population on side, and there had to be this healing process.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined, first of all, by Tim Marshall, former diplomatic editor of Sky News, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com, and author of the best-selling The Power of Geography, 10 Maps That Reveal the Future of Our World, among other titles. Tim, let's first address the main principle of this episode, this idea that politics should have no place in sport. Can we agree that where sport is concerned, that's just ridiculous?
Yeah, we can agree that, because even if the sporting bodies and the people who play the sports felt that way, there is no getting away that at the international level, it's political. It's political whether you get the event, which of course is a statement about your country. It's political what you call your country and which flag you march around with, which of course, as you know, upsets some people.
If politics and sport are going to be inextricably enmeshed, does that have to be a bad thing?
Again, not necessarily. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I've been looking at some examples, and if you go all the way back to 1968, especially in the light of 2020, 2021, that Black Power salute at the Mexico Olympics is now nowhere near as shocking as it was then. But you'd be hard-pushed to argue against what the two Black American athletes were saying. They were simply drawing attention to what was going on in the United States in the 60s. Ditto, I think the boycott of South Africa by sport under apartheid, because again, that shouldn't be a contentious issue. I would prefer politics to be kept out of sport, but that's a different argument to saying whether it works or not. I think it sometimes does work. I think Carlos and Smith in Mexico drew international attention to what was going on in the States and was part of the whole narrative of the 1960s. I think that the sporting boycott of South Africa was also a success. I think China has had successes in bullying people So it can work. I mean, sometimes it is almost virtue signaling that isn't going to change anything. I mean, the Russians did not immediately pull out of Afghanistan because the United States boycotted the Moscow Olympics. But that was more sort of big power politics that they had to be seen to be making a statement. Politics in sport does affect and can be successful, whether you like it or not.
Is there also a way in which a political context can, or indeed does, enliven the sporting event and make it a more gripping spectacle for the viewers, regardless of what their own politics might be, for, against, or indifferent? One thinks of those incredibly heavily freighted international football fixtures like the United States versus Iran at the 1998 World Cup, and possibly more interesting to you, England versus Argentina at the 1986 World Cup, which Argentina certainly seemed to perceive as some sort of rematch for the Falklands.
Well, they did. I once covered an Olympic basketball final between USA and USSR back in the days of the Cold War. Yes, I am that old. And it wasn't just about sport. It was about which political system was superior. And I think that's entirely negative. And I think it's negative, the England-Argentina one. That was 86, 4 years after the end of the Falklands War. And Maradona openly said, after his cheating handball, openly said, this was our revenge. I think this is why it's best to try and leave it out, even though it's inevitable that it will creep in.
Well, just finally then, and it kind of brings us back to where we came in, which was with John Carlos and Tommy Smith making the salute at the 1968 Mexico City Olympics, a political gesture we are definitely going to see at the European Football Championships, and very probably in some shape or form at the Olympics and at Copa America as well, is players taking the knee before games in support of Black Lives Matter. The England team have been doing it recently en masse, and their manager Gareth Southgate says they certainly intend to carry on doing it. Given that soccer is the closest thing to a global language that we have in sport, and actually possibly the closest thing that we have to a global language full stop, is there an argument that it is the best imaginable forum to make a global point like that?
Oh, it's the best one if you want publicity and to make a demonstration, because it remains the world's most popular game by a long way. I think it's problematic that it's almost being imposed, but I think it's utterly wrong to boo it. And hundreds of England fans have booed it, but hearteningly, thousands then drowned them out with the applause. So they are a clear majority. Many of them will be just out and out racists. Some people booing will feel that they're being patronized and they don't want this politicization in the game. And I do have some sympathy for people that think that this is so political, you're supporting the Black Lives Matter political movement, which has some interesting views on the world. And I think if it was better articulated, that you're not supporting the Black Lives political movement and the franchises of it that called for defunding of the police and all the other contentious issues, all you're doing is saying with the small letter B that Black Lives do matter. You're acknowledging that there is this huge problem still in the 21st century, and you're taking the knee to demonstrate your opposition to that. It's going to be pretty interesting across the summer and again once we get full stadiums. So it's a challenge, and it is a symbol of our times. You went back to the 68 Olympics. The year before that, Muhammad Ali, when he refused the draft, said, I ain't got no quarrel with these Viet Cong. That was all a narrative that played out in the 60s as we looked at that amazing struggle that happened. We will look back at this as part of that struggle, and God willing, those that are against it will look back and realize that this was a time when the world changed slowly again.
Tim Marshall, thank you for joining us. That was Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com and author of The Power of Geography and others. International sporting events are political before a ball has been kicked or a flame lit. The locations in which they are held are invariably chosen by political skullduggery and remain the cause of political controversy long after the decision has been made, as is presently being demonstrated by the hosts of the looming Olympics and Copa America. Joining me now from Tokyo is Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson and also Senior Correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who is here in London. Fernando, let's look first of all at your home country of Brazil. Brazil wasn't even supposed to be hosting the Copa America, so why is it?
Well, Andrew, that was very unexpected, even for me. I mean, the event was supposed to happen in Colombia, but because of the street protest in the country and also a little bit because of COVID-19, they decided to move to Argentina, who then refused because of a new wave of COVID-19. And of course, the Brazilian president, he accepted apparently in 10 minutes after receiving an email inviting Brazil to host the event, which is quite puzzling because some people say that we are at the beginning of the third wave. And as you know, Andrew, we've been talking here in the studio, the deaths of COVID in Brazil, they didn't really go down. So that kind of just shows that President Jair Bolsonaro, he don't care. He was always against any type of social distancing measures. I think he thinks that this will bring business to the country. But I think at the end, the whole image of the event's becoming quite negative. Even the players, they announced in recent days, they said, we are against organizing the Copa America, but we'll never say no to the Brazilian national team. So, you know, even the players were a bit conflicted with that.
Fiona, we are pursuing a theme here of countries insisting on putting on an international sporting event in obviously suboptimal circumstances in order, one presumes, to glean some measure of prestige on the world stage. As we've discussed, you and I, many times before, the Tokyo Olympics are supposed to be going ahead next month, despite the unpopularity of this among Japanese people. Does Japan's government see this as exactly that, as a question of national prestige?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Andrew. I think at this point, it's gone beyond that. I mean, you'd have to say that Prime Minister Suga has said repeatedly in so many words, if he had his way, it probably wouldn't be happening. He keeps on saying it's the IOC's decision. So I think for Japan, the feeling is sort of resignation. And I think with a few weeks to go until the opening ceremony, what seemed like quite a possible cancellation is becoming less likely now. And I think people accept that it's happening. And it's really how to manage that situation. Certainly domestically, it's gone down extremely badly for Prime Minister Suga. And internationally, at this point, I think what soft power there might have been is really waning. What he will be banking on, Suga, is a successful Olympics. But I think there will be a lot of sympathy for Japan. It's clear it's not a good time to hold the Olympics. And forging ahead, the health advisors have been queuing up to say it's a terrible idea. And you have to say the Japanese government seems very conflicted about the whole thing.
There's a compare and contrast exercise to be done here, Fernando, because Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, as you've already explained, is very far from conflicted about hosting the Copa America. Is he turning this into a culture war wedge issue within Brazil? Is this one of those things where people who are for Bolsonaro are for hosting the Copa America and vice versa?
Certainly, Andrew. And I think that's quite sad in a way, because, you know, I am kind of a sports fan. I do get excited when the Olympics are on, the Copa America. But it is very hard because, I mean, there's even a difference between the Tokyo Olympics and Brazil hosting Copa America. It's been such a last-minute decision. And clearly our number of cases and deaths is very different to Japan. The majority of countries in the world, if they were in the same situation, they probably wouldn't be hosting such an event. But of course, there's a lot of people in Brazil that are pro Bolsonaro, and they said, you know what, this event might bring some good things to the country. And you know what, Andrew, if the events go ahead with no problem, perhaps with no cases among players, maybe it could be a good thing for Bolsonaro. I don't think so at the moment, but you know, I might be wrong when the event starts, because that's what usually happens with those sports events. When they start, sometimes the atmosphere does change for the better.
Let's apply the same question to Japan, Fiona. For all the ambivalence about the Prime Minister and the government and the holding of this that you previously explained, might they be clinging to the idea that once the flame has been lit and the games are go, then the Japanese public will buy into it?
Yeah, I think there's certainly an element of that. And a big part of that is the fact that the vaccine rollout has finally started and is speeding up. It's going incredibly efficiently, as we'd expect from Japan. And at the moment, the predictions are that everyone will be vaccinated by November. It was looking very gloomy even a month ago. So that's a big change. What Suga has to calculate is he has a leadership election in September. His party, the LDP, there's going to be a general election by October. And I think the feeling is that regardless of the Olympics, the LDP will win. The opposition is in complete disarray in Japan. It's very fractured. And I think the LDP is fairly safe. Suga, though, is in a different position. He's really staked everything on the Olympics and the vaccine rollout. Now, by October, of course, the vaccine rollout will be in good shape. But I think it really hangs on how the Olympics goes.
Just as a final thought from each of you, it is the case that hosting a major international sporting tournament is something of a double-edged proposition for the host nation. On the upside, the whole world pays attention to you, and on the downside, the whole world pays attention to you. So, Fernando, first of all, in the case of Brazil, I guess what's the best that could happen and what's the worst that could happen?
Well, to be honest, I think for the world, it's going to be very hard for Brazil to gain anything when it comes to soft power of Copa America. Our image, Andrew, is quite shattered. I think if there will be any changes, it will be domestic. Perhaps for Bolsonaro's popularity inside the country. I don't think outside it would change a thing, to be honest. Which was very different, for example, for the 2014 World Cup and 2016 Olympics, which Brazil hosted, which I think they were done quite beautifully. You know, I don't think we had any massive issues. But of course, the issues that we had, corruption, perhaps spending a bit too much in new stadiums, but that came after, not during the events. But I think with Copa America, the mood in the country is also quite different. I think there will be quite a lot of protest. And the sad thing is, I think a lot of Brazilians probably they're not even going to watch the matches, which was something unthinkable a few years ago.
And a similar question to you, Fiona. If we proceed on the assumption that these Olympics are going to go ahead, as far as Japan is concerned, what would be as good as it could get and what would end up making them wish they'd pulled the plug when they had the chance?
Well, I think the worst case scenario is the one that everyone's talking about. Is this going to be a super spreader event? The alternative version is that COVID is not breaking out everywhere. It goes really well. And it is this signpost to normality. The feeling is that the IOC hasn't played this very well. There's a lot of negative feeling. Comments like, barring Armageddon, this thing is going ahead. That's not helpful. And I think that the Japanese government has got very tangled up with that. But if the Olympics go well, Suga could even survive the leadership election in September.
That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Fiona Wilson. Do stay with us. You're listening to The Foreign Desk on Monocle 24. Most discussion of sport and politics mixing is rooted in the assumption that any such crossover is bad. But what if it isn't? In 1995, South Africa hosted the Rugby World Cup, the first in which they had been allowed to compete. It was 2 years since apartheid had ended, one since Nelson Mandela had been elected president. Against all odds and expectations, South Africa won it, and Mandela seized the moment to make a startling gesture of reconciliation. Here is John Taylor, a former Wales rugby union international who was commentating for ITV when Springboks captain Francois Pienaar and Nelson Mandela lifted the Webb Ellis Trophy.
My decision to make myself unavailable for Wales against the Springboks in 69-70 actually stemmed from the Lions tour in 1968, which I did go on to South Africa. I was, like everybody else, 22 years old, wanting desperately to be a Lion. And although I was full of misgivings, really sort of had a bit of a debate with myself, I decided to actually take the easy way out, obey the rugby mantra, which was that we weren't supporting apartheid, we were building bridges, and become a Lion. That was probably the most important thing in my life. But when I got out there and was actually confronted with the realities of apartheid, it very soon became clear to me that this was something that was an absolute farce as far as the stance that rugby as a sport took, and the stance that really the British government took too. I was a teacher in a big comprehensive school in southwest London, every color, creed, and nationality. And I came to the conclusion that it was something I just couldn't square with my teaching job and what I was trying to do with my pupils. Going to South Africa and playing rugby in that environment was just something that I just couldn't square.
At least three coloured youths were killed outright before they could take cover. The police said they were using birdshot, designed to wound, not kill. But at short range, the ammunition was still deadly. Nearby buildings were peppered with gunshots.
I wrote to the secretary of the Welsh Rugby Union, said I wished to make myself unavailable, was told it would be treated as a matter of conscience. And then, unexpectedly, because I'd been a very prominent part of the team the year before, I was also left out of the squad for what was then the Five Nations Championship. Fortunately, Wales had a bad season. And after being beaten by Ireland 14-0, they still had France to play for the last game of the season, and I was called back in. But not before the South Wales Miners and a few other lefty-type organisations had sort of jumped in and pleaded my case and pointed out that obviously I was being left out for political reasons. But rugby was basically still determined to push this agenda that sport and politics shouldn't mix. And it was just an impossible thing. I could never get my head around it because it was so obvious that it was not the case. I was sharing a house with Mervyn Davies, number 8, and Merv was a little bit younger than me. We went together in the 71 Lions tour to New Zealand, but he wasn't there in 68. And people like Gareth Edwards, Phil Bennett, Gerald Davies. Gerald had some misgivings about going and eventually pulled out without saying he was pulling out directly because of apartheid. But the problem was the establishment. The establishment, I was told quite clearly by two very eminent RFU English senior figures that I should never be allowed to play international rugby again. You're either out of this or in this, and there's no halfway house and sneaking to the television and having a look. No regrets at all. I mean, my decision was made very, very clearly, pretty well by the end of the 1968 Lions tour. That was the absolute crucial bit of making me make my decision, because I did see apartheid in operation. And I very quickly spent some time with the anti-apartheid guys over here and came to the conclusion that it wasn't just a question of a protest. It was evident to me that the only way anything was going to change in South Africa was if they were isolated from cricket and rugby. The thought that Nelson Mandela would be president and the man in charge was just unthinkable. I think what you've got to remember in all this is the South African Rugby Board, which was the white rugby union out there, was prepared to do anything to stay in international rugby. Yet the reality on the ground, I always like to use the Group Areas Act as my barometer. It was originally created in 1950, and it basically stopped black and colored people from living in certain areas and pushed them more and more into the margins. But what you've got to realize is that between 1966, when it was amended in a big way, and 1984, when pressure was starting to build through sporting boycott, there were 10 at least amendments, all geared to basically pushing the black and colored communities further and further into the margins. So whatever Danny Craven and those people running the White South African Rugby Board were saying about, no, we're trying to liberalize sport, it was a nonsense. And it was actually a pretty sudden thing. As I say, I had come to the conclusion that the only way we could do anything about South Africa was to isolate them. And I'm thrilled to say it happened. And Mandela, leading up to his release, That all came about, I believe, partly, obviously only partly, because of the sporting boycott. And it was only when they were isolated that suddenly it literally came tumbling down. In 95, that cup final, I think probably the biggest surprise was Mandela going the whole hog and coming out in the Springbok jersey.
And when he walked into the dressing room wearing a Springbok on his heart, it was just, wow. He just stood there and he said, good luck, boys, and he turned around. And my number was on his back, and that was me. I couldn't sing the anthem because I knew I would cry. I was just so proud to be South Africa that day.
He was a star, wasn't he, Mandela? He absolutely really didn't put a foot wrong. And one of the reasons for embracing the Rugby World Cup instead of shunning it was that he realized he desperately needed the white population on side, and there had to be this healing process. And of course, he did it absolutely wonderfully.
There it is. Francois Pienaar and Nelson Mandela is cheering along with the whole of the stadium.
It was an unusual day for me because we had Trevor McDonald out on loan from ITN to help with the presentation of the program because he could use his clout to get an interview with Nelson Mandela, and he'd done that. But the bit that was unusual for me was they asked me if I would, because of my background, actually do the build-up to the game with Trevor.
Made such a terrific impression in this tournament, taking a short one, totally different, a mistake, but South Africa picking it up. So
some of the listeners will have seen the film Invictus, and there was a bit in Invictus where the Boeing 747 comes over the ground very low. And they tried to turn it in good Clint Eastwood style into a bit of fiction that there was fear of a terrorist attack. There wasn't. It was on our script. We knew that plane was coming over. But it came over so low, I have to tell you, it was incredibly frightening. And Trevor and I both ducked under our desk. But Trevor, being the wonderful broadcaster he is, just put his finger to his lips and said, say nothing. And we got back up on deck and carried on talking as if nothing had happened. But it was a wonderful, wonderful occasion. And I think people don't realize how close South Africa was to sort of, civil war might be a bit too strong, but it wasn't out of the question in those months before Mandela got into power. And he realized, he was the arch diplomat as well as politician, strong on his beliefs, wonderful man. And he knew he had to carry the white population with him. I basically sort of have to stop myself laughing every time I hear that sport and politics ought to be kept separate, because it has never, ever been possible. And we can go back into ancient history, but I mean, even coming into the relatively modern times from the 1936 Olympics onwards, sport has always been used. I used to commentate on gymnastics. I did four Olympics, and I had to go to Russia and China in the 70s and the 80s. And there was no question that they were using sport to actually showcase themselves. And it's been there forever. And I was ashamed of rugby and cricket, because that's not what their motivation was at all. It was basically that the rugby fraternity and the cricket fraternity were more important than the actual brotherhood of man. If we bring it right up to date with Black Lives Matter, the sportsmen have kept going as long as they have in making that protest, and I believe solidly that they should keep going and not stop until they've beaten the Boers.
John Taylor, thank you very much for joining us here on the Foreign Desk. And playing us out this week and making the point that sport and politics do mix and sometimes should, Nelson Mandela.
Sport has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire. It has the power to unite people in a way that little s does. It speaks to youth in a language they understand. Sport can create hope where once there was only despair. It is more powerful than governments in breaking down racial barriers. It laughs in the face of all types of discrimination.
That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Christy Evans, Rhys James and Emma Searle. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.